This morning, our guest, Joanna Misnick, talked about the need for left education and training. And on June 24th, Portland DSA did just that, organizing a summer day school at the Southeast Sunnyside Community Center. I was fortunate enough to have that day off, and I spent the entire day there. It was a very well-attended and, I will say, very successful event, and I want to congratulate the organizers for that. One of the participants, Katie Barrett, presented on climate change. Her talk was Climate Change, System Change, and the Need for a Planned Economy. And we're going to hear a portion of that this morning. Let me tell you a little bit about Katie, who is a member of Portland Rising Tide and a direct action organizer and trainer, and has been involved in the fight against expanding fossil fuel infrastructure for the past 4 years. Most recently, her work has been focused on educating people about the dangers of carbon pricing and market-based false solutions to climate crisis. We are going to pick up her talk at the point in which she begins to use some examples to educate about the shenanigans that go along with some of the market-based solutions, and then move into the alternative economic systems, including what is called just transition. We thank Katie for allowing us to use this information, and we'll go from there.
One example of how market-based solutions like cap and trade are working out. Because they've been in place for quite a few years now, and we have plenty of evidence to show that, just as we suspected, they're not doing so great. Now, what you hear is that renewable energy has doubled, but it went from 3% to a whopping 6%. Not exactly the huge transition that we need to see if we're going to switch to all renewables. Instead, what we see is a huge increase in the use of natural gas. Now, this natural gas is largely coming from fracking. The fracking boom has been a wild success for industry, partly because we've allowed industry to count natural gas as a cleaner fuel. It produces less CO2 when you burn it. So if you look at the results from this program, you do actually see reductions in CO2 emissions. But the problem is CO2 is not the only greenhouse gas. And the big problem with gas in particular is methane. The fracking process produces a lot of methane in the system. So while you burn it at the source and produce CO2 and produce less of it, you're introducing more methane, and that's not counted in these systems. But it's a big problem because methane is 82 times more potent than CO2. 82 times. In the short term, if we release more methane, we are likely to cook ourselves. And it just so happens that scientists a couple years ago started to notice a huge spike in methane, and they weren't sure where it was coming from. They suspected the U.S. because of the fracking boom. And lo and behold, studies were done to show that, yes, all of this fracking that we are now doing in the name of cleaner burning fuels is actually releasing massive amounts of methane into the atmosphere. And real quick, I just want to explain this. Because this is where our climate policy is. This is the only kind of climate policy that is on the table at the moment. Our cap and trade, cap and invest, carbon taxes, and the fee and dividend model, which is being promoted by a group called Citizens Climate Lobby. Citizens Climate Lobby, they say, this price on carbon is going to lower CO2 emissions by however much. We've got models that can prove it. So their vision of the future is that we just let the market decide. That the market is not giving us a switch to renewables like we need. The market is giving us mostly gas and nuclear, which is not really a sustainable option and not where we want to be headed. Another one of the problems with the direction that we're headed is that even if we were to put really high prices on carbon, on emissions, the market is not likely to stop those activities because the government is propping this stuff up with massive subsidies. So the government is intervening to keep the fossil fuel industry not just operating, but profitable. And about 45% of all U.S. oil production is subsidized. 45%. We have a government that has proven over and over again it is willing to give handouts to industry in the form of subsidies and tax breaks, and will no doubt continue that practice and make any efforts that we have ineffective. It is the golden rule of all capitalist enterprises that you must make a profit for your shareholders. CEOs are required to prioritize profits for shareholders. In fact, if you were to have a fossil fuel CEO who decided to be responsible and maybe think about the future of humanity and stop their activities, they would no doubt quickly be removed by the shareholders because that CEO is not doing their legally required job anymore. All CEOs answer to shareholders and must prioritize profits. But what we need is often not profitable. In the case of clean energy, we can look at solar. You notice that in the market-based scenarios, we don't see a whole lot of solar in that mix, even though experts will tell us that this is a big part of the solution. And why is that? Because it's not profitable for the big companies. Because the way they're used to doing business is these big power plants with centrally produced power that produce massive amounts and distribute it to customers. But solar, what we're looking at is what's called distributed energy or small-scale distributed energy. So if we have homes that are equipped with solar panels and producing their own energy, those are people that the energy companies are no longer able to profit from. So it is not in the best interest of profit-seeking companies to roll out things like distributed community solar, even though that is very clearly one of the things that we need. And of course, what's profitable is often harmful, as in like our continued reliance on natural gas. Natural gas obviously continues to be very profitable for companies, but they continue doing it. Not only are they doing it, but they're investing in major new infrastructure that will be around for decades. They are locking us into decades more of fossil fuel use because it's making them money, and it's really that simple. But the other problem we face is that capitalism requires growth. I don't know how many of you have ever heard economists talk about economic plans, but they're very obsessed with GDP, which is gross domestic product. GDP is always supposed to be going up. That is how we measure progress in a capitalist system, is how much are we growing. The idea is that the rising tide lifts all boats, supposedly. So if we just produce more and more and more, eventually those things will make it to all the people. Because that's clearly not what's happening. This is also part of the trickle-down theory. We improve things for everybody and it gets spread around somehow. Without growth, we actually have a recession, and if it's bad enough, we call it a depression. And part of this is high unemployment rates. Because if growth stalls or even contracts, then companies scale back. They cut jobs. They replan for the future. They cancel those plans to expand that they might have had. They start shrinking their operations. People lose their jobs. It has a cascading effect throughout the whole economy. If it gets bad enough, business after business will go under, and we could end up in a downward spiral that is uncontrollable because we need growth. Capitalism depends on it. So if we stop growing, the system collapses. However, we have this problem where we're already over-consuming resources. We're using resources 50% faster than they can be replenished globally. The American lifestyle in particular is a very high consumption lifestyle. And people like to talk about raising the standard of living for people, but if we were to have everybody in the world living the American lifestyle, we would require 5.3 planets. Clearly not in the cards. To top it off, there is a class system to this as well. We've got the world's richest 10% produce 50% of carbon emissions. And the reverse is that the poorest fraction of the planet living very low consumptive lifestyles. So what we need to do is address the difference between the global north and the global south. Because it's not the global south that is causing these problems. It is us. It is us in the US and Europe, in the developed countries. And, you know, you kind of have to ask yourself, is it really progress if we have developed a lifestyle that is unsustainable? Yeah, resource limits. It turns out they're a thing. They exist. Economists don't like to acknowledge this. As a matter of fact, if you've learned, never taken an economics class, they teach you to just ignore the idea of resource limits. We can act as if they exist in infinite supply because there's always going to be a substitute, they think. You know, if something becomes scarce, the price will go up, will shift to something else. But there are a lot of resources that simply have no substitute. And to top it off, this is a finite planet, and we will run out of things eventually. Yeah, it turns out this planet of ours has limits and boundaries, whether we like it or not. Beyond just climate change, we have biodiversity loss, major changes in land use, fresh water, ozone depletion, and the absorption of waste. Something that often doesn't come up when we're talking about climate change and other environmental problems is what we do with all of the waste and the things that we dump into the environment in various ways. There are limited capacities for the planet to absorb and deal with all of this stuff. So it is not just climate change that is our problem. And what happens when we ignore these limits? If we just keep plodding along as we have, the fact that we're using resources faster than they can be renewed is going to hit us. And it's going to hit us in the form of system collapse. So the choice we're basically faced with here is to do nothing and wait until the system collapses, which will be chaotic and bad for a lot of people, or we can have a managed decline. But that involves us intentionally coming together and making some decisions about how we make that happen. So when we talk about a managed decline, where we rein in our levels of production and consumption to sustainable rates, one step is obviously to cut unnecessary production. There is so much stuff that we produce that we simply don't need. Is it worth it for all of these things to be contributing to emissions, to contributing to resource depletion? This all comes at a cost. I need to start producing for human need and start focusing those resources that we have, taking the limited energy that will be available to us and focusing on the things we need, like obviously clean energy, public transportation. We need to take care of people's health. There are a lot of things that we do actually need, and we need to start shifting energy into those. Another piece of addressing climate change is to relocalize production. So right now, we are essentially exporting a lot of our pollution to developing or undeveloped countries. So we get all this stuff by making it a lot of times in Asia, where there are lax environmental and worker protections. We produce all of the pollution over there, and then we ship it halfway around the world over here. And that shipping itself is actually a very large source of emissions, in addition to all of the trucks that then take the stuff from the ships and transport it all over the country. So one piece of the puzzle is to try and minimize that, to try and bring production back to the local as much as possible, rely on local resources, and in doing so, we have the opportunity to bring back some skilled jobs too. We should be making whatever we can as close to where we are as possible. We also need to restructure the food system because it's a big part of the problem. We need to move away from synthetic fertilizers because if nothing else, we will run out of them. Do things like diversify crops, because one of our big systemic risks right now is monoculture. The whole don't put all your eggs in one basket thing is a potentially big problem, because even though we are dumping all of these pesticides on crops, we are also creating things like super bugs in the process, and it is likely just a matter of time before we end up with a pest that just goes nuts on a particular crop, and if that's all we have in the Midwest, all one thing, that's a huge risk. Anything happens to that crop, there is not a backup. So part of restructuring our food system is to bring back diversity, to lower the risk of our food system collapsing in those ways, to repair and protect the soil, which is a carbon sink, and again, to produce as much as possible locally. And we need to majorly rethink working jobs. And this is where it starts to really tie in with socialism. Because it's not just that we need to shift workers out of destructive industries and into building the stuff we need. We also need to produce less. If we're cutting back our production and consumption, that means we also should be able to work a lot less. Who doesn't want a world where we can work, I don't know, 20 hours a week and get by? Doesn't that sound great? Well, that's actually part of the climate solution. We need to reduce our waste and how much we are producing for the climate, and in doing so, can create a more enjoyable world for ourselves in the process. And part of that is to also cooperate instead of competing against one another. Because when we are when we have companies competing against each other, we're not able to then make those big decisions that we need to. We really do need cooperation across different businesses, across different industries and sectors to be able to make the decisions that will keep us within these natural limits that we're facing. How do we decide what we need? Who gets to make those decisions? This is also a big piece of the puzzle, because it's not enough to just have worker co-ops. Worker co-ops are great, but the thing is, though, we can't stop there. Workers making decisions in the workplace only gets us so far. We also need to involve other stakeholders in those decisions. Like, who are we producing for? Have we determined if this is something we need? What are the potential consequences to the surrounding community of producing this? And open up decision making in such a way that we can democratically make these choices. Because at some point there will be trade-offs. We will have to decide that a certain amount of pollution or extraction is worth it because we just need certain things. We're not realistically going to get to a point where we stop all industrial activity, and that's not something that I'm suggesting, but we do need to limit it to what we need. But in order to determine what people need, we actually need to involve people in making those decisions. So, you know, one possibility is not just for workers or producers' councils, but consumer councils, or to involve impacted communities in some way. Who needs to be involved? Who's going to be impacted? You hear in the climate movement a lot of talk of a just transition, and the just transition refers to not just our switching from fossil fuels to renewable energy. It's the just part is the justice, it is the social justice, and it is the piece that is required to fundamentally transform our economy. So in order to get closer to that just transition, some things that I mentioned, we need more inclusive decision-making structures. And especially as socialists, this is something that we need to start thinking about. What is our vision for the future? What does the system look like that we're proposing as an alternative? How are we going to change who is making decisions and transition away from having CEOs making decisions for the sake of profit to people and communities coming together to produce for human need? We also need to make sure that we're basing those decisions on natural limits, because regardless of what we might want, we need to keep our activity within those limits, which means when we're envisioning our system, how is that going to work? How are we going to identify those limits and then bring people together to decide how to fit our activity within it? The only fair way to do this is to involve people, to make it a democratic process. We need to chip away at corporate power. So instead of these market-based mechanisms, one step we could take is to push for direct regulation. Maybe even public takeovers of industry. We need to start thinking about how we actually remove the decision-making power and the power in general from corporations and shift it back to the people. Something we can also do in terms of policies, if we're looking at where to start with this, is to remove legal barriers to collective organizing and the things we need to do. Because there are actually a lot of obstacles preventing us from doing what we need to do because the corporate structure is ingrained in our system. And of course, part of a just transition is to redistribute wealth and resources. We're talking about taking away corporate power, evening playing field, redistributing resources, making decisions fairly and inclusively. So this is the vision that we need to keep in mind, and we absolutely need to be going after the fossil fuel industry and throwing ourselves at the gears of the system like we've been doing to stop the expansion, but we can't forget about the future that we want and what that looks like and what we need to do to build it.